First, fearful things should be examined directly, and their realism severely tested. Seneca, Epistles 13:8. We do not disprove and overthrow by argument the things that cause our fear. We do not examine into them. We tremble and retreat, just like soldiers who have abandoned their camp because of a dust cloud raised by stampeding cattle, or who are thrown into a panic by the spreading of some rumor of unknown veracity. And somehow or other, it is the false report that disturbs us most, for truth has its own definite boundaries. But that which arises from uncertainty is delivered over to guesswork and the license of a mind in terror. And if rational scrutiny doesn't dissolve fears, we can adjust our standard of proof until it does. Seneca invites us to fix the game in our favor. We might as well, because the adversary doesn't fight fair either. It's another case of questionable philosophy, but good psychology. Seneca, Epistles 13:13. Weigh your hopes against your fears. When everything is uncertain, favor your own side. Believe what you prefer. If fear obtains more votes, bend more the other way, nevertheless, and stop troubling yourself. 4. Don't borrow trouble. A next line of response to a fear, the feared thing might not happen. We often fail to discount enough for this possibility. Since whatever is feared may not come, we are foolish to agonize about it. Rather than causing us to suffer twice, when we might have suffered once, the fear can cause us to suffer once, when we need not have suffered at all. Seneca, Epistles 13:4-5. The things that terrify you, as if they were about to happen, may never come. Certainly they have not come yet. Some things torment us more than they should, some before they should, some when they should not torment us at all. Seneca, Epistles 13:10-11. It is likely that some bad thing will happen in the future, but it is not happening now. How often has the unexpected happened? How often has the expected never come to pass? Many things may intervene that will cause an impending or present danger to stop, or come to an end, or pass over to threaten someone else. A fire has opened up a means of escape. A disaster has let some men down gently. The sword has sometimes been withdrawn from the very throat. Men have survived their executioners. Even ill fate has its quirks. Perhaps it will be, perhaps it will not be. Meanwhile, it is not. When Seneca urged this line of thought, he said that he wasn't speaking as a Stoic. The upshot, nevertheless, fits comfortably among his other ideas. Still, it is one of the points in this book that the purist may regard as a teaching of a Stoic, rather than as a Stoic teaching. Schopenhauer, Our Relation to Ourselves, 1851. Only those evils which are sure to come at a definite date have any right to disturb us. And how few there are which fulfill this description. For evils are of two kinds. Either they are possible only, at most probable, or they are inevitable. Even in the case of evils, which are sure to happen, the time at which they will happen is uncertain. A man who is always preparing for either class of evil will not have a moment of peace left him. So if we are not to lose all comfort in life through the fear of evils, some of which are uncertain in themselves and others, in the time at which they will occur, we should look upon the one kind as never likely to happen and the other as not likely to happen very soon. 5. And what if it does? Suppose, finally, that your fears do end up being realized. Maybe they are not so bad after all if looked at realistically, or their ultimate consequences may be harder to judge than they seem. In any event, you will deal with them by use of the same resources that allow you to cope here and now. Seneca, Epistles 24:2. I will conduct you to peace of mind by another route. If you would put off all worry, assume that what you fear may happen will certainly happen. Whatever the evil may be, measure it in your own mind, and estimate the amount of your fear. You will soon understand that what you fear is either not great or not of long duration. Seneca Epistles 13:14. Let someone else say, perhaps the worst will not happen. You say, and what if it does? Let us see who wins. Perhaps it is happening for my benefit, and such a death will dignify my life. The hemlock made Socrates great. Pry from his hand Cato's sword, the vindicator of his freedom, and you take away the greater part of his glory. This theme, ways in which things that we fear sometimes turn out to be for the best, is taken up in more detail in chapter 10, section 8. Marcus Aurelius, Meditations 7:8. Do not let things still in the future disturb you, for you will come to them, if need be, carrying the same reason you now employ when dealing with things in the present. 6. Anger. This is the passion that Seneca discusses most extensively, on the dangers and costs of anger. Seneca on Anger, 1:2:1. If you will look at the effects of anger, and at the harm it has done, no plague has been more costly to mankind. You will see slaughters and poisonings, the mutual vileness of litigants, the downfall of cities, and the destruction of entire nations. Princes sold into slavery at auction, houses put to the torch, fires not confined within city walls, but vast stretches of countryside aglow with enemy flame. Seneca on Anger, 1:18:2. Reason considers nothing but the question at issue. Anger is moved by trifling things that lie outside the case, an overconfident demeanor, a voice too loud, unrestrained speech, over-refined attire, over-solicitous advocacy, popularity with the public. Anger is inflamed by all of them. Many times it will condemn the accused because it hates his lawyer. Even if the truth is piled up before its very eyes, it loves error and upholds it. It refuses to be convinced and counts persistence in what is wrongly begun to be more honorable than penitence. Seneca Epistles 18:15. Great anger ends in madness, and therefore anger is to be avoided, for the sake not of moderation, but of sanity. Anger may have been of special interest to Seneca because its destructive potential was on such lavish display during his times. He writes, for example, of the wrath of Vedius Pollio. When angry with his slaves, Vedius fed them to his lampreys, a species of toothed, eel-like, blood-sucking fish that was a popular delicacy in Rome. We met them in passing in chapter 5. The Emperor Augustus was a guest when one of Vedius's slaves was ordered to be killed in this way for breaking a crystal cup. According to Seneca, Augustus ordered that the slave's life be spared, and that Vedius's other cups be broken in front of him. Seneca, if he were here to do so, might cite the decline in the incidence of this sort of problem as some further evidence that the extent and expression of our anger are up to us. 7. Anger as opinion. Anger provides, indeed, a good example of the necessary role of opinion or judgment in forming an emotion. Though anger may take on a life of its own, it begins and is supported by beliefs we hold about the subject of it. One can see this by thinking of any real case of anger and observing how the emotion tends to change or vanish if it is found to have been based on mistaken beliefs. You think that your goods have been carelessly damaged. They turn out to have been someone else's. You thought something bad was done to you on purpose. You discover that it was an honest mistake. The feelings follow the facts, or rather, your thoughts about the facts. The Stoic views all cases of anger as open to this kind of analysis, even if the factual details that support the anger aren't wrong in the ways just described. The anger still has to depend on other beliefs, too, that are certainly mistaken from a Stoic standpoint, such as a belief that the subject is worth getting angry about. Seneca on Anger, 2:1-3. There can be no doubt that anger is aroused by the impression that we have been wronged. The question, however, is whether anger follows immediately from that impression and springs up without assistance from the mind, or whether it is aroused only with the mind's cooperation. Our opinion is that it ventures nothing by itself, but acts only with the approval of the mind. For to form the impression of having received an injury and to want to avenge it, and then to couple together the two propositions that one ought not to have been wronged and that one ought to be avenged, this is not a mere impulse of the mind acting without our volition. So first, Stoic remedy for anger, as for other such problems, is a return to chapter 1. Recognize it as an opinion and let it go. Seneca Epistles 96:1. Still you are indignant and complain, and you don't understand that in all the evils to which you refer, there is really only one, that you are indignant and complain. Seneca Epistles 123:1. Nothing is heavy if we take it lightly. Nothing need provoke anger if one does not add one's anger to it. Marcus Aurelius, Meditations 11:18. It is not what men do that disturbs us, for those acts are matters of their own control and reasoning, but our opinions of what they do. Take away those opinions, dismiss your judgment that this is something terrible, and your anger goes away as well. 8. Uses of humor. But as we have seen at various earlier points in the book, the Stoics understand that inner disturbances aren't always possible to get rid of in that way. So we have here the same pattern seen in Chapter 7, Section 8, on the handling of insults, a topic closely related to our current one. Beyond treating anger as an opinion to be dropped, the Stoics offer other remedies as well, ways to redirect the mind and substitute better ideas for unproductive ones. One such response to anger is to make light of its cause. A Stoic needs a good sense of humor. Seneca on Tranquility of Mind, 15:2. We should bring ourselves to see all the vices of the crowd not as hateful, but as ridiculous. And we should imitate Democritus rather than Heraclitus. For the latter, every time he went out into public, used to weep. The former used to laugh. One saw everything we do as wretchedness, the other as absurdity. Things should be made light of and taken more easily. It is more civilized to laugh at life than to bewail it. Democritus and Heraclitus were pre-Socratic Greek philosophers. Heraclitus died early in the 5th century BC, and Democritus was born soon afterwards. Democritus became known as the laughing philosopher for finding the comic side of all things, Heraclitus as the weeping philosopher for his darker view. The pairing of the two in this way evidently was an invention of Sotion, one of Seneca's teachers from childhood. It should be noted that Stoicism doesn't commend laughter at the expense of others. Seneca on Tranquility of Mind, 15:5. It is better to accept common behavior and human vices calmly, without bursting into either laughter or tears. For to be hurt by the sufferings of others is to be forever miserable, while to enjoy the sufferings of others is an inhuman pleasure. It is good humor at the expense of oneself, and about the affronts one receives that is fully endorsed by the Stoic. Self-effacing humor disarms an opponent, and makes the user of it a less appealing target of attack. See Chapter 7, Section 11. Humor has other uses that the Stoics recognize as well. One who manages to be amused by an attack rises above it and diminishes the attacker. Above all, however, and most to our point, humor can cause anger to dissolve. Seneca on the Constancy of the Wise Man, 18:6. Let us look at the examples of those whose forbearance we praise, such as Socrates, who took in good humor the public jests made at his expense, seen on stage in the comedies, no less than when his wife, Xantippe, had doused him with the chamber pot. Antisthenes was taunted with the fact that his mother was a barbarian, being a Thracian. He answered that even the mother of the gods came from Mount Ida in Crete. Seneca on Anger, 3:11:2. There are various ways in which anger can be checked. Many things can be turned into a game and a joke. They say that when Socrates once received a blow on the head, he merely said that it was too bad that a man could not tell when he ought to go out wearing a helmet. What matters is not how offense is given, but how it is received. Seneca on Anger, 3:38:2. As Cato was arguing a case, Lentulus, that violent partisan, remembered by our fathers, gathered as much thick saliva as he could, and spat right in the middle of Cato's forehead. Cato wiped off his face and said, "I'll assure everyone, Lentulus, that they're wrong when they say that you're not worth spit." This last passage involves a pun that does not translate well literally. Cato really told Lentulus that they were wrong to say he had no mouth. It was a play on words in Latin. I've sought to suggest something equivalent in English. Seneca on the Consistency of the Wise Man, 14:1. Some are offended if a hairdresser jostles them. They see an insult in the surliness of a doorkeeper, the arrogance of an attendant, the haughtiness of a valet. What laughter such things should draw! With what satisfaction should your mind be filled when you contrast your own peace of mind with the unrest into which others blunder? Seneca on Anger, 3:34, 1-2. Believe me, these things that incense us not a little are little things, like the trifles that drive children to quarrels and blows. Not one of them, though we take them so tragically, is a serious matter. Not one is important. That is where your anger and madness come from, I tell you. The fact that you attach such value to trifles. 9. Uses of delay. Some simple Stoic advice. Wait before acting when angry. The first essay in chapter 13 will suggest that Stoicism is a shortcut to the frame of mind created naturally by the passage of time. Here the point is the reverse. Those who can't maintain an even temper by philosophical effort can get there by letting some time go by. Seneca on Anger, 2:29-1. The best corrective of anger lies in delay. Ask this concession from anger at the outset, not in order that it may pardon, but in order that it may judge. Its first assaults are heavy. It will leave off if it waits. And do not try to destroy it all at once. Attacked piecemeal, it will be conquered completely. Plutarch on Controlling Anger, 2:459f-460a. Who among us is so harsh as to whip and chastise a slave because 5 or 10 days ago he burned the food, or knocked over the table, or was slow to come when called? And yet these are the very things that, when they have just happened and are fresh in our minds, upset us and make us harsh and implacable. For just like bodies seen through a fog, so things seen through a mist of rage appear greater than they are. 10. Avoiding causes for anger. Here is a more Stoic pragmatism. A good way to avoid anger is to avoid situations where it is likely to be aroused, or at least to avoid seeking them out in ways that we might find tempting. Seneca observes that people sometimes want to know whatever has been said about them that might be cause for resentment. But these provocations are so hard to see clearly and fairly that we're usually better off ignorant of them. Seneca on Anger, 3:11-1. You don't want to be irritable? Don't be inquisitive. People who try to find out what has been said about them, who dig up malicious gossip, even if it happened in private, are only upsetting themselves. Our interpretations can make things appear to be insults, when some should be put aside, others laughed at, others forgiven. Seneca praised the self-control of this kind showed by rulers who declined to expose themselves to causes for anger. Seneca on Anger, 2:23-4. The great Julius Caesar displayed the same quality, on showing himself so merciful in victory in the Civil War. When he discovered packets of letters written to Pompey by people who probably belonged to the opposing or neutral party, he burned them. However moderate his tendency to anger might have been, he preferred to avoid any occasion for it. The most graceful form of forgiveness, he thought, was not to know the offense that might have been given by each of them. In view of the Stoics' usual insistence on the unvarnished truth, one might wish they had discussed more fully when it is better not to know than to know. but it may be enough for the everyday Stoic to recognize it as a question that should be answered more deliberately than is common. The same restraint can also be applied internally, that is, to how we interpret things once we do hear them. Seneca saw that we sometimes have an appetite for indignation, or at any rate are too quick to find grounds for it. We should tilt the other way, being slow to construe what others say as offensive or hostile, and learning to distrust suspicious instincts. Seneca on Anger, 2:24-1-2. Suspicion and surmise, those deceptive provocations, ought to be banished from the mind. This man did not give me a civil greeting. That one did not embrace me as I kissed him. That one broke off the conversation abruptly. That one did not invite me to dinner. That one tried to avoid seeing me. Grounds for suspicion will never be lacking. But we need to be straightforward and to see things in their best light. We should believe only what is thrust under our eyes and becomes unmistakable. And every time our suspicion proves to be groundless, we should blame our own credulity. This rebuke will develop the habit of being slow to believe. The Stoics do not usually pause to acknowledge that a reaction may be easier for some to tame than for others, just because we are born with different temperaments. But Seneca does sometimes talk about this. We saw examples in section 1 of this chapter, and in chapter 6, section 9, on pleasures and games, where he distinguished between the challenges faced by fiery dispositions and those that might be described as either dry or watery. When it comes to anger, too, some need to take different precautions than others. Seneca on Anger, 2:22. As for nature, it is difficult to alter it, and we may not change the elements that were combined once for all at our birth. But though this be so, it is profitable to know that fiery temperaments should be kept away from wine, which Plato thinks ought to be forbidden to children, protesting against adding fire to fire. Plutarch on Controlling Anger, 13, 461f to 462a. Anyone who is quick to anger should abstain from rare and curiously wrought things like drinking cups and seal rings and precious stones, for their loss drives their owner out of his senses more than do objects which are common and easily procured. This is the reason why, when Nero had an octagonal tent built, an enormous thing, and a sight to be seen for its beauty and costliness, Seneca remarked, "You have proved yourself a poor man, for if you ever lose this, you will not have the means to procure another like it." And indeed it did so happen that the ship which conveyed it was sunk and the tent lost. But Nero remembered Seneca's saying, and bore his loss with greater moderation. Nero was a prolific executioner, of his rivals, of his first wife, of his mother, and of various others, finally including Seneca. So one may wonder if Plutarch wrote that passage with some irony. But what the greater moderation of Nero looked like in this case is not recorded. 11. The endlessness of anger. Seneca holds that if anger is ever warranted by externals, it is warranted constantly. Life overflows with good grounds for annoyance. Seneca on Anger, 2:7-1. What is more unworthy of the wise man than that his emotion should depend on the wickedness of others? Shall great Socrates lose the power to carry back home the same look he had when he left? If the wise man is to be angered by low deeds, if he is to be upset and unsettled by crimes, surely nothing is more woeful than the wise man's lot. His whole life will be passed in anger and in grief. For what moment will there be when he will not see something to disapprove of? That passage alludes to what Xantippe, the wife of Socrates, is recorded as having said about him, that when the state was oppressed with 1,000 miseries, Socrates still always went out and came home with the same look, for he bore a mind smooth and cheerful on all occasions, far remote from grief, and above all from fear. Elian, Various Histories, 9:7. the pattern of argument used by Seneca in the last excerpt, the no end to it argument, is common in Stoicism. If you are ever going to get upset about X, you should realize that chances for X are everywhere, so you might as well be upset all the time, or be sensible and stop ever, or so often, getting upset about X at all. We have seen this idea apply to sensitivity to insults, to worry about what others think, and now to anger about wrongdoing. Elsewhere, Seneca applies it to sadness. Seneca, Consolation to Polybius, 4:2-3. Come, look about you. Survey all mortals. Everywhere there is ample and constant reason for weeping. Tears will fail us sooner than the causes for grief. Such is the way we spend our lives. And so we ought to do in moderation this thing we must do so often. 12. Justice without anger. To conclude our discussion of anger, we might reflect briefly on whether it is needed to support values such as justice. The opposition of the Stoics to anger will sometimes raise questions about whether they are pacifists, and too detached to care about righting wrongs. Not in the least. The Stoic disposition affects the spirit in which justice is administered, and in which the good is pursued, but it does not imply mild views about the substance of those things, or timidity in securing them. Seneca on Anger, 1:19-2. If need be, reason silently, quietly, wipes out whole families root and branch, and households that are a plague on the state it destroys, along with wives and children. It tears down their very houses, leveling them to the ground, and exterminates the names of the enemies of liberty. All this it will do, but with no gnashing of the teeth, no violent shaking of the head, nothing that would be unseemly for a judge whose countenance should at no time be more calm and unmoved than when delivering a weighty sentence. The Stoic judge, in something like the spirit of the dispassionate physician, is concerned with deterrence and rehabilitation, with the good of the community and the good of the offender very broadly understood, rather than with retribution. Some further thoughts on how such a judge might think. Seneca on Anger, 1:19-7. Quoting Plato, Laws, 11:9-34. He will look to the future, not to the past, for as Plato says, a sensible person does not punish a man because he has done wrong, but in order to keep him from doing wrong. For while the past cannot be recalled, the future may be forestalled, and he will openly kill those whom he wishes to have serve as examples of the wickedness that is slow to yield. Not so much that they themselves may be destroyed, as that the destruction may deter others. These are the things a man must weigh and consider. And you see how free he ought to be from all emotion when he proceeds to deal with a matter that requires the utmost caution, the use of power over life and death. The Stoic sees honor in fighting to the death for a good cause, and takes a perspective broad enough to identify virtue on both sides of a conflict. Seneca Epistles, 66:13. Great is Scipio, who lays siege to Numantia, and constrains and compels the hands of an enemy, whom he could not conquer, to resort to their own destruction. Great also are the souls of the defenders, men who know that, as long as the path to death lies open, the blockade is not complete, men who breathe their last in the arms of liberty. Numantia, also mentioned in Chapter 4, was a city in Spain that was besieged by the Romans in 134 BC. The siege lasted for 13 months, at the end of which the inhabitants killed themselves rather than surrender. For readers wishing to keep their Scipio straight, the one referenced here is Scipio Aemilianus, adoptive grandson of Scipio Africanus, the Roman general who had defeated Hannibal about 60 years earlier. Neither is to be confused with Metellus Scipio, encountered in Chapter 4, Section 7. As these passages show, Stoic detachment does not imply a shortage of engagement with the world or reluctance to act in it. The detachment of the Stoic is a technique for preserving one's equilibrium and seeing the world accurately. The requirements of justice are a separate matter, and one very important to the Stoics. Choices about how to spend one's time and energy are likewise a separate issue, one on which the Stoic advice is exactly the opposite of withdrawal. See Chapter 11 for more on those points. These excerpts, and the longer discussions from which they come, can still raise additional questions. How exactly do Stoics, with all their detachment, find the will or motivation to fight hard and successfully for things, to give them their all, so to speak, without caring too much about them? Or, perhaps to say it better, without caring about them the wrong way? One possibility is that they cheat on their stoicism a bit, and sometimes become more invested in externals than they say they should. We see glimpses of this from time to time in Seneca, but more satisfying answers are available as well. The good Stoic, while regarding any particular case with detachment, may have a strong commitment to ideals that allow the case to nevertheless be treated as urgent. The best doctors care intensely about their patients and will fight hard to help any one of them. They do give it their all. But those same doctors tend not to get emotional about it, and are able to move on from any individual failure quickly enough. They have to. This approximate mindset, with its combination of commitment and detachment, is one way to think about the balance to which Stoics aspire more generally. We will come back to this line of thought in Chapter 13. 13. Grief. The greatest challenge to the Stoic approach to emotion has probably been the unavoidability of grief over a loss. A fairly uncompromising view of the subject is suggested in the accounts of the early Stoics given by later authors. Seneca's view of grief is more measured. He acknowledges that no one can avoid grieving on some occasions, and he does not describe this as a mistake. He claims rather that natural grief creates a risk of excess when we feed it and urge it on with our thoughts. A. Grief and Opinion. Seneca, Consolation to Marcia, 7:1. But surely to grieve for one's relatives is natural. Who denies it? So long as it is in proper measure. Merely the parting, let alone the loss of those dearest to us, brings an unavoidable sting and a tightness even to the stoutest heart. But expectation adds something more to our grief than nature has commanded. Seneca, Epistles, 99:18-19. When the news of a bitter death first hits us, when we are holding the body that is about to pass from our embrace into the flames, a natural compulsion wrings out our tears. The breath of life, struck by the blow of grief, shakes the whole body and likewise the eyes, from which it presses out and discharges the adjoining moisture. Such tears, being forced out, fall against our will. Tears of a different kind escape when we recall the memory of those we have lost. These we allow, but the former overcome us. Seneca, Epistles, 99:27. What we teach is honorable, that when emotion has wrung some tears from us and has, so to speak, stopped frothing, the mind is not to be given over to grief. Seneca was careful to distinguish his position from others that he considered less reasonable. He was probably talking here about other Stoics. Seneca, Consolation to Polybius, 18:5-6. I well know that there are those whose wisdom is harsh rather than brave, who deny that the wise man will ever grieve. But these people, it seems to me, can never have run into this sort of misfortune. If they had, fortune would have knocked their proud philosophy out of them and forced them to admit the truth even against their will. Reason will have accomplished enough if it removes from grief only what is both excessive and superfluous. That reason should not allow grief to exist at all is neither to be hoped nor desired. Rather, let reason establish a measure that will copy neither indifference nor madness, and will keep us in the state that is the mark of an affectionate and not an unbalanced mind. Let your tears flow, but let them also cease. Let deepest sighs be drawn from your breast, but let those, too, come to an end. So rule your mind that you can win approval both from wise men and from brothers. Seneca's writing on these themes was informed by experience. When he was in his 40s, he had a son who died early. The passage just shown appears to have been written a few years later. B. Grief and Mastery. Seneca offered views on the process of overcoming grief. He thought it was appropriate to have the feeling for a while, to reckon with it, and then to reason it to the ground. This is preferable to dealing with grief by distracting ourselves or just waiting until it wears off. Seneca, Consolation to Helvia, 16:1. When you have lost one of those dearest to you, to suffer endless grief is foolish indulgence, to suffer none, inhuman hardness. The best middle course between devotion and reason is to feel a sense of loss and to subdue it. Seneca, Consolation to Helvia, 17:1-2. No emotion is governable, least of all that which is born of grief. It is wild and stubbornly resists every remedy. Sometimes we want to conceal it and to choke back our sobs, yet tears pour down the face despite its assumed composure. Sometimes we occupy the mind with games or gladiators, but amid the very sights meant to divert it, some slight reminder of grief makes the mind break down. Therefore, it is better to conquer sorrow than to trick it. For sorrow that has been deceived and diverted by pleasures and engagements rises again, and from this very respite gathers strength for its raging. But the grief that has yielded to reason is settled forever. Seneca, Epistles, 63:12. I know that what I am about to add is very trite, but I am not going to omit it just because everyone says it. If grief is not brought to an end by the use of your judgment, it is brought to an end by the passage of time. Yet the basest remedy for grief, for a person of sense, is to become tired of it. I would rather you abandon your grief than have your grief abandon you. You should stop doing soon that which, even if you wish, you cannot do for long. C. Grief and Futility. The Stoics speak of conquering grief with reason. Some of the reasoning they offer for the purpose is found in Chapter 4 of this book, On Death. But they also offer ideas specifically about grief and its reduction. One of them is that grief does no good for its subject, nor perhaps for anyone else. Marcus Aurelius, Meditations, 8:37. Does Panthea or Pergamus now sit by the tomb of Verus? Does Caurius or Diotimus sit by the tomb of Hadrian? Ridiculous. Well, suppose they did sit there. Would the dead be aware of it? And if the dead were aware of it, would they be pleased? Passages like this make their point whether or not one knows who the author is talking about. But nevertheless, Verus was the adoptive brother of Marcus Aurelius, and they were co-emperors until Verus died in 169. Panthea was Verus's mistress. Hadrian was an earlier emperor, one of those known as the five good emperors, along with Marcus Aurelius himself. The others he mentions are unknown. Seneca, Consolation to Polybius, 2:1. And it will help you, too, not a little, if you reflect that your grief can accomplish nothing, either for the one whose loss you mourn or for yourself, for you will not want to prolong what is useless. Seneca, Consolation to Polybius, 5:1-2. No one is less pleased by your grief than the person to whom it seems to be offered. Either he does not want you to suffer, or he does not know that you do. So your supposed duty has no point. If he for whom it is performed is unaware of it, it is useless. If he is aware of it, he does not like it. I may say boldly that there is no one in the whole wide world who takes the slightest pleasure in your tears. Cicero, Tusculan Disputations, 3:27. Is there anything more effective in overcoming sorrow than realizing that it does no good and is pointless to take up? D. Grief and Memory. The Stoic also finds solace for grief in memories, which Seneca regards as things with an ongoing existence. Memories live securely in the world of all that has been, which need not be so different as existing in the present. They can have much value to us. Seneca, Epistles 99:4-5. Believe me, a great part of those we have loved remains with us, even if some accident has taken them away. Bygone time belongs to us, nor is anything stored more securely than what has been. We are ungrateful for what we have already received because of our hope for what is yet to be, as if whatever is to be, if it comes to us at all, will not quickly pass over to what has already been. Seneca, Epistles 63:6-7. If we believe our friend Attalus, thinking of friends who are alive and well is like enjoying honey and cake. The remembrance of friends who have died delights us, but with a certain bitterness. Yet who will deny that sour things, with a touch of sharpness, can also whet the appetite? I don't agree. Thinking of my deceased friends is sweet and pleasant to me. I had them as if I was going to lose them. I have lost them as if I have them still. For more on the Stoic treatment of memory, see Chapter 8, Section 2. 14. Limitations. This chapter has sought to present the late Stoic teachings on emotion in a practical way, but I want to end by briefly noting some complexities that this discussion has avoided, and that some readers may wish to pursue separately. The early Greek Stoics took a hardline view of emotion along the lines discussed in Section 8 of this chapter. They held that every emotion amounts to a judgment. A person experiencing an emotion is agreeing to a proposition such as, "This is something to be enraged about," and the agreement is a mistake because it involves attachment to an external, namely, whatever the object of the emotion might be. Seneca relaxed that approach a bit, as we have seen, but the basic idea is still present in all forms of Stoicism. It is a theory, especially in its strict form, that has been criticized on many grounds. Infants and animals seem to be capable of anger and fear, for example, but the Greek Stoic view makes it hard to understand how such creatures could have any emotions at all, for they lack the mental capacity to form propositions or assent to them. There have been efforts to save the Stoic theory from this problem by revising it a bit. The late Stoics, at least, knew that the judgments we hold can be ingrained and nonverbal, as noted in Chapter 1. Maybe animals and infants, too, can be viewed as making nonverbal evaluations of events that produce their emotions. The analysis of these and related questions by modern philosophers has been extensive and complex, and the thinking of the Greek Stoics about emotion is itself quite involved. It includes an elaborate taxonomy of the emotions and claims about where they each come from. None of that can be done justice in this space, but those who wish to pursue these avenues of Stoic theory can start by consulting the recent scholarly work of Martha Nussbaum and Margaret Graver, which discusses it all in detail. Chapter 10. Adversity. Stoics avoid adversity in the ways that anyone of sense would, but sometimes it comes regardless, and then the Stoic goal is to see adversity rightly and not let one's peace of mind be destroyed by its arrival. Indeed, the aim of the Stoic is something more, to accept reversal without shock and to make it grist for the creation of greater things. Nobody wants hardship in any particular case, but it is a necessary element in the formation of worthy people and worthy achievements that, in the long run, we do want. Stoics seek the value in whatever happens. Adversity resembles death in this respect. It is both an external that we misjudge and a resource that might be put to use. On a Stoic view, we don't like adversity. That's mostly what it means for something to be adversity, for the same reason that we misjudge many other externals. We view them with psychological parochialism, defining size and value and better and worse in terms of our immediate wishes and convenience. Stepping away from the wishes and convenience allows adversity to be seen as it is, as often less monstrous than it looks when it first comes, as sometimes producing important benefits, and in any event, as inevitable. Stoicism offers a series of strategies for turning adversity to good. We cannot choose what happens to us, but we can choose how to react to it. So when a setback comes, Stoics interpret it as constructively as possible, as a chance to prove oneself, or to learn, or to build anew. And the value of any of these responses may be greater than the cost of the adversity. Stoics also have a modest opinion of their ability to predict future events, so they are slow to assume that an apparently unwelcome development will be for the worse in the long run. Finally, the Stoics have techniques for reducing the force of adversity by thinking in certain ways about it, looking at their own adversity from another's point of view, anticipating it in advance, and understanding how acceptance of it and adaptation to it can help with its management. 1. Preferences. Since their philosophy has sometimes been misinterpreted on this point, we might begin by noting that the Stoics, while unafraid of adversity and ready to turn it to good use, preferred to avoid it. Seneca, Epistles 85:26. On your view, he says, a brave man will expose himself to dangers. Not at all. He will not fear them, but he will avoid them. Caution suits him, not fear. Seneca, Epistles 67:4. Why wouldn't I prefer that war not break out? But if it should come, my hope is to nobly bear the wounds, the starvation, and all else that it must bring with it. I am not so mad as to want to be ill. But if I must be ill, my hope is that I do nothing immoderate or weak. It is not hardships that are desirable, but the courage by which to endure them. Montaigne of Constancy, 1580. All honorable means of protecting ourselves from harm are not only permitted but commendable. The chief function of constancy is to patiently endure those hardships that cannot be avoided. The same goes for difficult people, encounters with whom may be considered a type of adversity. We can avoid them with dignity and without hatred or fear. Marcus Aurelius, Meditations 6:20. Suppose someone in the ring has scratched you with his fingernails and butt you with his head, thus causing you some hurt. We don't mark him down as bad. We don't take offense. We don't suspect him later of plotting against us. We are merely on our guard, not treating him as an enemy or with suspicion, but with friendly avoidance. Something like this should be the rule in other parts of life. Let us disregard many things in those who are, as it were, our sparring partners. For, as I have said, it is possible to avoid them without being suspicious and without being hateful. The friendly avoidance recommended by Marcus Aurelius is not high on the list of theoretical innovations made by the Stoics, but it rates well if one measures a teaching by how often it is of use. 2. Inevitability. The Stoic regards adversity as inseparable from existence, and so as best met with an accepting spirit. Seneca, Epistles 107:2. The condition of life is that of a bathhouse, a crowd, a journey. Some things are thrown at you. Others just happen by accident. Life is not a dainty affair. You have started on a long road. Inevitably, you will stumble. You will knock into things. You will fall. You will grow weary. You will cry out, "Oh, for death!" In other words, you will tell lies. You will forsake a companion in one place. You will bury one in another. Elsewhere, you will be afraid of one. It is through troubles of that sort that this rugged journey must be made. Marcus Aurelius used a different analogy, a comparison between the mind that receives adversity and other parts of the body that accept and process what comes to them. Marcus Aurelius, Meditations 10:35. A healthy eye should see all there is to see, not say, "I want to see green things," for that is a sign that the eyes are diseased. And healthy hearing and a healthy sense of smell should be ready for all that there is to be heard and smelled. So too a healthy mind should be ready for whatever may come to pass. The mind that says, "Let my children be safe," and "Let everyone praise whatever I may do," is an eye that seeks green things, or teeth that seek out only what is tender. Montaigne offered yet another comparison. The variety of things that we experience, welcome and not, may be likened to the elements of music. Montaigne of Experience, 1580. We must learn to put up with what we cannot avoid. Our life, like the harmony of the world, is composed of contrary things, of diverse tones, sweet and harsh, sharp and flat, sprightly and solemn. The musician who only loved some of them, what would he be able to do? He has to know how to make use of them all and be able to mix them together. We must do the same with the good and the bad, which are of the same substance as our lives. These views of adversity, as an unavoidable part of life and inseparable from the good, have some other implications for how we think and talk. For one, Stoics don't see the point of complaining about things that are inherent to human existence. Here we find the closest that philosophical Stoicism comes to the modern meaning of that word. Marcus Aurelius, Meditations, 850. This cucumber is bitter. Throw it away. There are brambles in the road. Turn aside. That's enough. Don't go on to say, why are there such things in the world? You would be ridiculed by any student of nature, just as you would be laughed at by the carpenter and the shoemaker if you criticized them because you saw shavings and trimmings from the things that they make in their workshops. Seneca on the Happy Life, 15:6-7. What madness to be dragged when one could follow! As much, I swear, as it is folly and ignorance of one's lot to grieve because you lack something, or because something affects you adversely, or to be surprised and indignant at those things that happen to the good and the bad alike. I mean deaths, funerals, infirmities, and all the other accidents besetting human life. Whatever the ways of the universe may require us to suffer, let us take it up with high-mindedness. This is the oath by which we are bound, to bear with the human condition, and not to be disturbed by what we do not have the power to avoid. Nor are Stoics much interested in blame. Epictetus, Enchiridion, 5. It is the act of an ill-instructed man to blame others for his own bad condition. It is the act of one who has begun to be instructed to lay the blame on himself, and of one whose instruction is complete to blame neither another nor himself. Stoics think the ills that come with life should be accepted by considering their potential in advance, before they happen to anyone in particular. They are, after all, potential hazards faced by everyone. We do not encounter the same misfortunes, but we often are equal in the risks to which we are subject as mortals. Seneca, Epistles, 107:6. Let us not wonder at any of those misfortunes to which we are born, and which no one should complain of, because they are the same for all. The same, I say. For even what a man has escaped, he might have suffered. An equal law indeed is not one that all experience, but one that is established for all. Let your mind treat this sense of equity as a rule, and let us pay without complaint the taxes that come with mortality. Montaigne of Experience, 1580. It is unjust to complain that what may happen to anyone has happened to someone. But the response of the Stoics to adversity involves more than a lack of blame and complaint. They seek to meet whatever they can't avoid with a welcoming spirit. Seneca, Epistles, 107:9-10. Whatever happens, let your mind suppose it was bound to happen, and do not rail at nature. Epictetus, Enchiridion, 8. Don't insist that what happens should happen as you wish. Wish that things happen as they actually happen. Then your life will go well. Friedrich Nietzsche was not a Stoic, but his notion of amor fati, love of one's fate, has often been associated with the idea just shown from Epictetus. Nietzsche, Ecce Homo, 1888. My formula for greatness in man is amor fati, the fact that a man wishes nothing to be different, either in front of him or behind him, or for all eternity. Not only must the necessary be born, and on no account concealed, all idealism is falsehood in the face of necessity, but it must also be loved. 3. Hermes' Magic Wand. Stoics view adversity, or developments contrary to one's wishes, as misjudged in various ways we can now consider. Adversity is a raw material needed for building strong things. To adjust the comparison, an unwanted card has been dealt, or the dice have come up a certain way. The Stoic goal is to avoid even the feeling of, oh no, wherever possible on these occasions, and to replace it with sentiments closer to, now what? Or, let's see what can be done with this. The work of life is to turn whatever happens to constructive ends. That is the most important Stoic idea about adversity, and a theme to which all of its authors contribute, often with metaphors. Epictetus adapted for Stoic use the caduceus, or wand, that Hermes was said to use to perform feats of magic. But the alchemy the Stoic has in mind turns adversity into advantage. Epictetus, Discourses 3:20-12. This is Hermes' magic wand. Touch it to anything you like, they say, and the wand will turn it to gold. Not so. Bring anything you like, rather, and I'll make it something good. Bring disease, bring death, bring poverty, bring insults, bring punishment for high crimes. All these things will be made beneficial by Hermes' magic wand. The obstacle in the path, Marcus Aurelius, Meditations 5:20. The mind turns around every hindrance to its activity and converts it to further its purpose. The impediment to action becomes part of the action. The obstacle in our way becomes the way forward. The fire that consumes setbacks and burns more strongly, Marcus Aurelius, Meditations 4:1. The power within that rules us, when it is aligned with nature, is so made as to adapt itself easily to whatever happens, and to whatever is possible. It needs no particular material. It advances its purpose as circumstance allows. Whatever is placed in its way, it makes into material for itself, as when fire overcomes the things that are thrown onto it, by which a little flame would have been put out. The strong fire quickly appropriates and consumes anything heaped on top, and from this the flames rise still higher. The sculptor who works with whatever materials are at hand, Seneca, Epistles 85:40. Do you think that the wise man is burdened by evils? He makes use of them. It was not only from ivory that Phidias knew how to make statues. He made them also from bronze. If you had given him marble, or some still lesser material, he would have carved the best statue that could be made of it. So the wise man will display virtue amid riches if possible, but if not, in poverty. At home, if he can, but if not, in exile. As a general, if he can, but if not, as a soldier. In sound health, if he can, but if not, then in weakness. Whatever fortune he is dealt, he will make of it something remarkable. The Animal Tamer, Seneca, Epistles 85:41. There are some animal tamers who compel even the wildest beasts, and the most terrifying, to submit to man. Not satisfied with eliminating their ferocity, they pacify them to the point that they might be roommates. The lion master puts his hand in the animal's mouth. The keeper kisses his tiger. The tiny Ethiopian commands the elephant to kneel down and walk the tightrope. In the same way, the sage is a skillful master of misfortune. Pain, want, disgrace, prison, exile are frightful anywhere. But when they come to the wise man, they are tamed. Bees. Plutarch on Tranquility of Mind, 5, 467b to 467c. Those who are without skill and sense as to how they should live, like sick people whose bodies can endure neither heat nor cold, are elated by good fortune and depressed by adversity. And they are greatly disturbed by both, or rather by themselves in both, and not less in those circumstances called good. But men of sense, just as bees extract honey from thyme, the most pungent and the driest of plants, often in like manner draw from the most unfavorable circumstances something which suits them and is useful. More literal expressions of the point are, of course, possible as well. Plutarch on Virtue and Vice 4, 101d to e. By the aid of philosophy, you will live not unpleasantly, for you will learn to extract pleasure from all places and things. Wealth will make you happy, because it will enable you to benefit many, and poverty, as you will then have few things to worry about, and glory, as it will make you honored, and obscurity, for you will then be safe from envy. Seneca also notes the value of humor, a recurrent and underappreciated Stoic theme. Sometimes the force of unwanted events can be turned to good by viewing them with a sense of comedy. Seneca on Tranquility of Mind, 10.1. In any sort of life, you will find amusements, recreations, and pleasures, if you are willing to make light of evils, rather than treat them as hateful. 4. Equipment. The Stoics consider us equipped to manage whatever adversity life may devise for us. Marcus Aurelius, Meditations 5.18. Nothing happens to anyone that he is not formed by nature to bear. Seneca, Epistles 90.16. Nature did not want us to be harassed. Whatever it requires of us, it has equipped us for. Epictetus and Chiridion 10. Whatever happens to you, remember to turn to yourself and ask what power you have for dealing with it. If you see a good-looking boy or woman, you'll find that the power for such things is self-control. If hard labor is at hand, you will find endurance. If abusive language, you will find patience. And if you make this a habit, the appearances of things will not carry you away with them. 5. Adversity as proving ground. Turning to more specific ways in which adversity may be converted to good, it may be a chance to prove oneself. Setbacks show what we are really capable of doing. Seneca on Providence 5.10. Fire tests gold, misfortune brave men. Seneca's way of expressing this idea, Ignis aurum probat, miseria fortes viros, became well known, but the substance of it was a proverb of long standing. It appears also in Ecclesiasticus 2.5, part of the Biblical Apocrypha. Seneca Epistles 67.14. In this connection, our friend Demetrius comes to mind. An untroubled life in which fortune makes no inroads, he calls a dead sea. To have nothing to stir you and rouse you to action, no attack by which to try the strength of your spirit, merely to lie in unshaken idleness, this is not to be tranquil. It is to be stranded in a windless calm. In De Bello Gallico, Caesar had once turned the phrase Malachia a Tranquillitas, describing the sea. It meant dead calm and stillness. Seneca played on this by saying at the end of this last passage, this is not tranquillitas, this is malachia. Malachia also had the meaning in Greek of moral softness. As for Demetrius, he was a Cynic philosopher and a friend of Seneca's. There was no windless calm for him. He was banished from Rome with other philosophers in 71 AD. Another analogy. We should welcome adversity in the same way we welcome an adversary in a game. Seneca on Providence 2.4. Without an adversary, virtue shrivels. We see how great and how powerful it really is, only when it shows by endurance what it is capable of. Be assured that good men should act likewise. They should not shrink from hardships and difficulties, nor complain against fate. We should make the best of whatever happens and turn it to good. Seneca on Providence 4:2-3. You are a great man, but how do I know it if fortune gives you no opportunity to show your worth? You have entered the Olympic Games, but you are the only contestant. You gain the crown, not the victory. I congratulate you not as a brave man, but as I would someone who had obtained a consulship or praetorship. You're getting quite famous. Likewise, I might say to a good man, if no harder circumstance has given him the chance to show his strength of mind, I judge you unfortunate because you have never been unfortunate. You have passed through life without an antagonist. No one will know what you can do, not even you yourself. Johnson the Adventurer, Number 3, 1753. To strive with difficulties and to conquer them is the highest human felicity. The next is to strive and deserve to conquer. But he whose life has passed without a contest, and who can boast neither success nor merit, can survey himself only as a useless filler of existence. and if he is content with his own character, must owe his satisfaction to insensibility. 6. Adversity as training. Adversity may be viewed as training, or as a chance to learn. No one is likely to accomplish anything great who doesn't know how to work with setbacks. So the Stoic thinks we need to gain a certain ease about them, an ability to adapt. A misfortune can be viewed as part of that learning process. Epictetus, Discourses 1:24-1:2. It is the crisis that reveals the man. So when it arrives, remember that God, like a wrestling coach, has put you up against a rough, young antagonist. Why, you ask? So that you can be an Olympic champion. For this cannot be achieved without sweat. Seneca on Providence 4:12-13. We should offer ourselves to fortune so that by our struggles with it, we may be hardened against it. Fortune will gradually make us an even match for itself. Constant contending with danger will instill a contempt for danger. In the same way the bodies of sailors are hardened by the beating of the sea, the hands of farmers are calloused, the arms of soldiers have the strength to throw their weapons, and the legs of a runner are nimble. We are strongest in what we have exercised. It is by suffering ills that the mind learns defiance of suffering. Schopenhauer, Worldly Fortune, 1851. We may regard the petty